Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Marcus Speller. Welcome to the Barcelona Legacy Podcast. This is the sixth of a six-part series to coincide with the release of the Barcelona Legacy, a book that explores how the evolution of today's game begins at Barcelona 25 years ago with the pioneering ideas of Johan Cruyff and was taken on by the likes of Louis van Gaal, Jose Mourinho and Pep Guardiola. It's written by one of our panellists, Jonathan Wilson, who writes for The Guardian, Sports Illustrated and World Soccer, and it's out this month in hardback, ebook and audiobook. In this, the last episode in the series, we bring our story full circle to a match that had a huge influence on the career paths and styles of play of both Jose Mourinho and Pep Guardiola. It's Barcelona 5, Real Madrid 0 in the 2010-11 La Liga season. And to help us discuss this, we have Ian Hawkey from the Sunday Times, who has written a biography of Alfredo Di Stefano and was based in Barcelona during this period. So, Jonathan, why have you chosen this match as our final stopping point?
It's related to the previous podcast we did, that Mourinho has been brought in, having masterminded Inter's victory over Barca. He's been brought in by Real Madrid as the man who can stop Guardiola. He's a man who can stop Barca. And this is the first meeting, and it goes disastrously wrong for him. So this is the peak of Guardiola at Barcelona. This demolition of his archenemy in a beautiful style. And though he subsequently goes on to beat Mourinho's Real Madrid in the Champions League semi-final, that was a much bloodier game, it was a much more attritional game. It was less of a spectacle. It was less a stylistic triumph. And what follows that is the slow destruction of Guardiola at Barcelona, brought about by the poison Mourinho injects in those semi-finals. And then, of course, you know, it goes on to Mourinho winning the league the following season with Real Madrid, Guardiola leaving Barcelona, and ultimately them both ending up in Manchester.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, Ian, you were obviously, as we say, based in Barcelona. It felt like the sort of the zenith, as Jonathan's saying, of what Guardiola achieved at Barcelona. It must have been an extraordinary thing to witness and be a part of.
It was an amazing night. It was very charged anyway, because it was an unusual fixture. It was a Monday night. It was pouring with rain, so there was sort of an atmosphere around the place. And in some ways, even the outcome was a surprise. Madrid had started the season, this is late November, Madrid had started the season slightly better in terms of points. They were slightly above Barca in the table. And then you had this wonderful display of passing football and the products of La Masia, the players who had come through the system, starring individually. And David Villa, who was the new signing, the big new signing that summer, doing exactly what Guardiola wanted from his strikers, which hadn't happened in the previous seasons under Guardiola. So all in all, it was perfect, except, I suppose, for the unpleasantness, if we were going to be a little bit puritanical about it. It was nasty at the end, mainly from usual suspects of Real Madrid, but also there was some provocation from the Barca players. So, yeah, there was certainly a charge around it.
Yeah, it certainly was, I don't know if a prelude is the right word to use, but it certainly added a bit more spice, as if the Clásico needed that from what would happen, you know, into the new year and in the Champions League and those four Clásicos.
I think the point that Ian makes, it was a Monday night, is actually quite significant. Mm. That, you know, the whole world had been waiting to see what was going to happen when Mourinho met Guardiola. Yeah, you know, because Mourinho did seem to be the person who could stop that style. You know, this style that had seemed sort of unstoppable when they beat Manchester United in 2009 in the Champions League final. You sort of thought, how can anybody live with that? Well, Inter showed how you could stop it. But could Mourinho then do it with Real Madrid? And so it's a Monday night because of Catalan elections. But what that means is There's no other games. Everybody was watching it. The whole world was watching it. And, you know, there's a story about Wayne Rooney watching at home, standing up and applauding in his living room because, you know, he was so sort of taken by that style. Well, if it had been a Sunday, Wayne Rooney would have been playing for Manchester United. He wouldn't have been able to do that. So he had this sense of a game apart, almost like a world title boxing fight, you know, a heavyweight fight, that it was something that everybody had been waiting for and everybody was watching.
Yeah, and Ian, were people surprised the way Mourinho and Real Madrid approached the game? Because, you know, you said yourself that people in Barcelona were surprised it was 5-0. It was such a demolition. Bearing in mind, as we talked on a previous podcast, how Mourinho's Inter got the better of Barcelona, the way he approached this game, do you think he was, I don't want to say proving a point that the way Real Madrid like to approach things, they don't want to resort to dirty tactics and admit to that the opposition is better. But Mourinho has done that so often in his career. Were you surprised at how he almost let the club influence his approach to the game or the history of the club?
Well, in a sense that so much of modern Barca Madrid is a yin and yang thing. So Mourinho was employed to be the anti-Guardiola, the anti-Barcelonista. So in a sense, that's what one club does, the other club does something different. That is a very difficult dynamic to resist. And of course, there was expectation that because of the way Mourinho's Inter had got past Barcelona only a few months earlier, there would be shades of that, which was, you know, that meant it was a test for Guardiola too. So how have you evolved? The more surprising thing in the detail of the game was the way Mourinho reacted at half time when they were down. He brought on Lassana Diarra, who is a figurehead for, well, let's put it bluntly, spoiling football, which seemed a very odd thing to do and which demanded some explanation.
You're bringing on an ex-Pompey player in a Clásico.
That was not the first thought in Barcelona minds, but but it was certainly... the funny thing, there's a detail here. Lassana Diarra ended up with the number 10 shirt at Real Madrid, you know, for various Byzantine means, which was always something that made you smile. Madrid resorted to this really dirty word, the trivote, which means three defensive midfielders, in a position where they were losing a game. And clearly this looked like damage limitation and calling damage limitation at a very early stage. So that was surprising and disappointing. Mourinho's explanation for this was that, he wanted to release the strikers. But really, he was very... His attitude afterwards was that Barcelona are a complete side. We're not there yet. So he built this up as, we're rock bottom. We're going to have to work on this. And in the eventual narrative, I suppose he did, because Madrid progressed from there in their relationship with Barcelona over the next 2 years under Mourinho.
But I mean, even from the start of the game, you know, he was trying to play as he played with Inter. He was trying to play a low block. Quite whether you can do that with Mesut Ozil, you know, is one of your three central midfielders or not, I'm not sure. But because Barcelona were different. They weren't the Barcelona they'd been in the semi-final. There's no Ibrahimovic there. And that, I think, is significant. The fact that Villa had come in, they were much more mobile. And so if you look at that first quarter of an hour, I mean, Barca scored twice in the first 14 minutes, but they also hit the post. Messi hit the post even before the first goal.
Yeah, they were all over him.
And they were picking holes in back four because you had Villa and you had Pedro cutting in field. You had them creating the angles that when you have Ibrahimovic, you're just a little bit more static, you're a little bit more predictable in your movement. And so Villa's willingness to sacrifice himself, to play on the wing, to make those decoy runs inside or to make the runs to get little three balls from Messi dropping deep from a false nine position, all of that was different to what had happened in the semi-final. So Barca had evolved. Mourinho's tried to play the same tactics. And in quarter of an hour, they're 2-0 down. Xavi got the first goal and Pedro got the second. And that second goal...
Gets the cross in! 2-0 Barcelona! A flying Pedro!
Was it 21 passes?
21 passes in the sequence leading up to it, yes. And as some of the local press noted, I think all of those 21 passes involving Spanish players. So in Barca's case, that would have meant academy players plus Villa. A small fact, but a fact noted.
And then half-time, yeah, he tries this with Trivotto, bringing on Diarra. So you've got Xabi Alonso, Khedira and Diarra. And so they push a bit higher. Yeah, the idea is to press in midfield, to keep the back four and those three very, very close together, to keep that compact. And you try and press the ball when Barca have it, but also to lure Barca on to use Ronaldo's pace in behind them. But by playing a higher line, they just open themselves up. So Villa scores two goals very, very quickly, and both of them are just little slip balls through a defence that's pushed high and can't get back. And part of the problem there is that Casillas, great goalkeeper though he is, although maybe Mourinho would dispute that, was not able to play. You know, his natural game is not to play on the edge of his box, as you have to do behind a defence that pushes high. So suddenly, you know, they're 4-0 down after 50-odd minutes, which, you know, it becomes a bloodbath. Is what can we do? All we can do is spoil. And in the final goal,
they're aiming for their fifth as we're into stoppage
time. Scored by a totally forgotten man.
It will! Jeffrey, the substitute, has joined the party. A great goal.
Jeffrey. Yeah. And set up by Bojan.
Yes.
So, again, there was a nice little gloss on this that two academy youngsters had come through to complete this massacre.
Do you think, Jonathan, with this legacy, of course, that we're talking about with Barcelona, the fact, you know, Ian was saying that it's the yin and yang, when one side does one thing, the other club does another. I mean, this was sort of ultimate Barcelona, wasn't it? That not only were they hammering Real Madrid, they were hammering them with such style, and they were forcing Real Madrid to try and play the destroyer role. And so it was almost like a double whammy for them.
Yeah, well, almost triple, because they're doing it with kids.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
You know, they're doing it with people they've produced, if not kids, at least people they've produced themselves. So, you know, Real Madrid, a team who historically had always bought the best talent, and you know, the whole culture of a club is based around bringing big stars, this idea of sort of aristocracy and the seniorio. Well, they had to abandon the seniorio code, this idea of gentlemanliness. And, of course, Mourinho uses this game as a springboard to sort of get rid of all those traditions and do things his way. I mean, the ultimate result of this game is Jorge Valdano losing his job as sporting director. That Mourinho uses the magnitude of a defeat. He very cleverly spins it to his ends to say, actually, this is a systemic problem at the club and we need to change everything. And he'd had these huge problems with Valdano. And, you know, we mentioned in the last podcast that Mourinho's celebration after Inter's win is, it's not that of a manager, it's that of a player.
Yeah.
That he runs from the bench as the final whistle goes with his finger raised in the air to the away fans.
Well, yeah, like he'd scored.
That's not what a manager does. You know, that's what a centre forward does. Mm. This idea that of him as somebody who wanted to be a player and never made it as a player, and that, I think, always niggled away at him. And I think that lies behind the sense of insecurity that he felt when he was a coach at Barca. He was never quite accepted. He was always the outsider. He was always just the translator. He was never the coach. He was never a former player. And Valdano had written the famous piece in Marca in 2007 after Mourinho's Chelsea had lost to Liverpool in the Champions League semi-final. And, you know, the famous line from that is, you put a shit hanging from a stick in an art gallery, you know, it doesn't make it art. But he goes on in that piece to make the very astute point, I think, that the reason that Benitez and Mourinho play like that is because they never made it as players. They don't trust players because they couldn't imagine trusting themselves on the pitch. So he says that they became the managers they as players would have needed to perform at a high level. They become very controlling. Everything becomes about the system. There's no improvisation. There's no faith in the players. And that, I think, really hurt Mourinho. So Valdano, yeah, has to be got rid of, both politically, you know, to allow Mourinho to put his own structure in place. But also, I think Mourinho was aware that Valdano had seen through him.
Yeah, personally, he wanted to get rid of him as well. And you contrast that with Barcelona, Ian. And they looked like they were having a lovely time. Now, obviously, Guardiola has, you know, parts of his character and approach have been criticised before. But those players, whereas at Real Madrid, you know, certain members of the hierarchy and, you know, as Jonathan just described there, it all seemed a bit, hang on, what is this madman doing? At Barcelona, full faith in Pep Guardiola, and his players did as well. And the aforementioned Ibrahimovic, who was very critical, he He only lasted, was it a season there?
One season, yeah.
Yeah, so this Barcelona side that beat Real Madrid, would you say, compared to the other ones, obviously Guardiola had great success and he wasn't there just for a season, was this the team? Was this peak Pep Guardiola's football at Barcelona, I suppose?
Yes, I think it probably was. I think institutionally, he was already having some difficulties upstairs. But, as you say, the club more or less supported him in the rejection of Ibrahimovic. And in turn, they also supported him with the recruitment of David Villa, which, as I say, was the striker he wanted. His story is that Ibrahimovic was somehow forced on him in a complicated deal involving the removal of Samuel Eto'o to Inter. Eto'o also he hadn't really wanted, but came around to because Eto'o rolled up his sleeves, as he does, and turned out to be very valuable for a season. So in that sense, if you're talking about the agreement, the institutional agreement and support of Guardiola, yes, he was yielding the benefits of that support, although things were changing a little bit upstairs because there was an issue over the presidency. And clearly on the field, this was a very homogenous, happy, thriving, confident team with backup from within. And yeah, so I guess if you're looking for a peak Guardiola at Barcelona, this wasn't a bad time because it was a Clásico. This was it, and they overtook Madrid and were on their way to a second Champions League in three seasons. So yes.
And it was Mourinho's Inter that stopped them from doing back-to-back Champions League titles, of course. But what did Guardiola change after that defeat to Inter, Jonathan?
I think getting rid of Ibrahimovic was hugely important, and partly in terms of the harmony of a dressing room. Ibrahimovic's autobiography, if that's the right word, and I'm not sure it's not, a sort of imaginative biography written in the first person, makes clear that right from the start, Ibrahimovic and Guardiola did not get on. That Ibrahimovic would, for instance, turn up in his Ferrari or a Porsche, and Guardiola would say, "You've got to come in the club car." You know, the whole culture of the club is we don't get above ourselves. And Ibrahimovic sort of took this as Guardiola sort of seeing in Ibrahimovic the sort of flashiness of somebody who'd come from this very poor background in Sweden. He'd come from Rosengård and in Malmo. And sort of the ostentatious display of somebody who's come from nowhere and suddenly has wealth, but of course Guardiola had come from nowhere. He's from a very ordinary working class background before he got to Barcelona, and the demand that people drive a club car is entirely reasonable. And Ibrahim just goes on to sort of talk about the other Barcelona players as just being these little schoolboys, kind of you're standing there nodding, doing what they're told, and that wasn't his style at all. As we mentioned in the last podcast, that sort of reached a peak around the time of those Inter games, that he got injured in the first one. So getting rid of him was necessary for harmony, but it was also, I think, tactically, he'd never fitted in. He never did the work he was supposed to do. Maybe he wasn't even capable of doing it. Being as big as he is, can you make those darting little runs? Can you be that mobile? Maybe he couldn't, but certainly temperamentally he couldn't do it. And he clearly became very frustrated by Messi's preeminence in the squad and having to play second fiddle to Messi.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Did you know that Xavi Hernandez used to scan over 8 times in the 10 seconds before receiving the ball? It's therefore not surprising that he rarely lost it. Scientific studies have shown just how important scanning is in soccer. Players who scan more, for example, make twice as many successful forward passes than those who scan less. But training this skill is difficult, and that's why thousands of players trust Be Your Best, the soccer training app in virtual reality, designed to improve players' game intelligence. To learn more, visit beyourbest.com and use code POD20 to get 20% off your first subscription.
5-0, that was the game, and that made everyone think, right, what is Mourinho going to do now and how are they going to approach the games? And of course, we were then treated to four Clásicos in 18 days later on in the season. And that's where it became a bit more physical from Real Madrid. Barcelona didn't have such a huge margin of victory, but more often than not, they did come out the victors in those games, and they did get the better of Mourinho overall. And of course, in the semi-final of the Champions League, they won 3-1 on aggregate. And the first leg in at the Bernabeu, two great goals from Lionel Messi, and Guardiola described going through in the second leg as I think it was the best night of his life or something like that. And Guardiola that season and in those Clásicos, Ian, certainly got the better of Real Madrid and Mourinho.
Yes, he did. I mean, things had moved on by the time there were three meetings, because there was a Copa del Rey final as well. Mm-hmm. In this short space of time. So, I mean, you know, this is wonderful for broadcasters. You know, you have this this seething rivalry going on, and you know, you have this three-way, these three meetings in three different venues and two different competitions. But things have moved on, certainly at Real Madrid, because Mourinho, having used in many ways the 5-0 defeat as a platform for saying it's my way or the highway, look what the highway looked like, had gained some political power in the sense that Valdano had gone. He'd got the centre forward, not the centre forward, but a centre forward in the January transfer window, Emmanuel Adebayor. Because he wanted a target man. He'd been going on about Hugo Almeida the previous summer. So he got his target man. And he'd got a bit more of a grip on things. And slightly mysteriously, he, after a lot of doubt from Florentino Perez, the president, he now appeared to have Perez on side, which is obviously very empowering. So things were looking up, in a sense, when these collisions came around. They didn't look up for very long, because Lionel Messi was superb in the away leg, which was the first leg, and Barca finished that 2-0. Meanwhile, there was a lot of aggro. Going back to the 5-0 briefly, that had finished with a red card for Sergio Ramos. Yeah. What's new, you might ask? But this one was particularly interesting in the context of 2010, because he was sent off for slapping Carlos Puyol, who had been his partner in Spain's World Cup squad. And on the way to slapping Carlos Puyol, he'd also shoved his hand in Xavi's face. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these were two quite important national team colleagues. And Piqué, Gerard Piqué, had sort of advanced his role as provocateur, which is one he still occupies, by putting up the open hand, signalling five goals at the 5-0 victory, which was not taken very well. And in fact, possibly informed what follows. Mm. Although Sergio Ramos's fuse doesn't need much lighting, but all this was still there. And in some ways, the two managers manipulated it. Mm. I think Jose Mourinho appreciated this greater display of aggression from some Madrid players, and he certainly discouraged the friendships that had built up in the national team. He wanted the competition to be abrasive. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, informed what followed, which was a breakdown in his relationship with Iker Casillas, who was, of course, captain of the Spanish national team, extremely close to Barcelona's Xavi. Mm-hmm. And this series of Clásicos put a lot of pressure on that relationship and certainly had an effect within the Spanish national squad. So all that's going on at the same time.
Yeah.
Barca are clearly the better side in the Champions League semi-finals, in which Mourinho again adopts some tactics which you might criticise: a bit too much spoiling, a bit too much containment.
Well, we should probably say what happened in those four games. So yeah. The league game finishes 1-1. Raul Albiol is sent off, I mean, clearly correctly, and yet Mourinho uses that to go, well, it'd be lovely to see what happened if we could actually play with 11 against Barcelona. But that draw, you know, although it's obviously a much better result than the 5-0, it pretty much confirms Barcelona are going to win the title. So it's a draw that suits Barcelona absolutely. Copa del Rey final finishes 1-0 to Real Madrid. Cristiano Ronaldo scores the winner in extra time, which I guess at least shows that Barca are beatable. But it had been a tight game. It'd been chances at both ends. Pedro had a goal ruled out for offside. It was offside, but fractional. Something Guardiola acknowledged in the press conference afterwards. He said, you know, I can't remember the exact line, but something about a well-placed linesman gave a 2-centimetre decision. So he's not disputing it. He's just saying it was close. But of course, Mourinho being the master of this kind of thing.
Yeah, he's thinking, that's my role.
Before the first leg of a Champions League, says, oh, you know, now we have a new category of manager, the category of manager who complains when referees get decisions right. And he stirs the pot as expertly as he does. And for the first time, Guardiola reacts. And he comes in, you know, an hour later, whatever, for his press conference and gives this 2-minute, 23-second rant in which I presume, were you there, Ian?
Yes, I was, yes. And it was extraordinary. And he was, you know, he was quite heated and it was clearly pre-prepared. And he, you know, there was a lot of rhetoric to it. He appeared to be praising Mourinho because he says, you are the, I'm not sure if we can say this on air, puta madre of press conferences. This is your domain, you know, mm-hmm. Your champion here. I can't compete. And then, of course, proceeds to try and compete with a very studied analysis of Mourinho's strength at press conferences or whatever it is. Within that, he also reminds everybody who's listening that they have this long shared past. He refers back to when Mourinho was a Barcelona figure, an assistant coach, and as Jonathan knows, that they actually had a good relationship. They had a stimulating relationship. Guardiola, more than a lot of players in that dressing room back in the Bobby Robson era, enjoyed Mourinho, really appreciated his fine mind, his analysis, and Mourinho enjoyed getting feedback from one of the more thoughtful, certainly one of the more analytical players in the dressing room.
And I know we said this before, but I think it's worth reiterating. If you look at the footage immediately after the Barca have won the Cup Winners' Cup final, so final whistle goes, the coaching staff run on the pitch, as is normal, and Mourinho makes straight for Guardiola, and it's not just a run up to him, hug him, move on to the next person. They point at each other, and they clearly say something to each other. And that sort of seeking him out, I think, suggests a level of affection and mutual respect that perhaps is greater than certainly Guardiola now acknowledges. So I think they were, I mean, close, I don't know, but they had a stronger relationship than many players and coaches would have. So yeah, they had been very close. And actually, the Barca players are very, they react to this Guardiola rant with a level of relief and you know, it's like the tension's been broken. Thank goodness he's finally come out and started, you know, started batting for us. But then the game is a horrible, horrible game, but it's full of spoiling. Barca don't help. There's a lot of play acting. Every time there's a foul or something approaching a foul, everybody surrounds the referee. Real Madrid have set up with Pepe as the most advanced of three midfielders with Xabi Alonso and Lissana Diarra. And this is at home. This is at the Bernabeu in a Champions League semi-final. And then, of course, surprise, surprise, Pepe sent off. And, you know, Real Madrid sort of protest about this decision. But, you know, it's a knee-high challenge on Dani Alves, which, even if it doesn't make contact, is a knee-high challenge with the studs raised. So maybe if it had been a yellow card, it wouldn't have been a travesty. But you can't complain it being a red. And Barcelona then take advantage of this. Messi scores the first one across the Maffelai.
That's right. Yeah.
And the second goal is an absolutely brilliant goal, but sort of become forgotten. This is the genius of Mourinho's propaganda. By banging on and on and on about the red card, we forget what a sensational goal that was. I mean, I'd say easily in Messi's top 10 goals of all time, probably in his top 5, at a key moment of a Champions League semi-final against Real Madrid. Mm. That should be a goal that's replayed over and over again, and it's disappeared.
Yeah, and particularly striking that night because things had become so ill-tempered, unpleasant, which had, you know, also disturbed the rhythm of the game. Here was this footballer rising above it with a moment of wonderful skill and coolness. And you know, he was almost alone for that because, as you say, there wasn't the villains that night were not only the players in white. There was a lot of simulation from Barcelona. Well, there was a lot of,
and that's an interesting point. It's something I want to ask you about is that it was at this time. Well, certainly for me, when really the narrative was Real Madrid were the bad guys and Barcelona were the good guys. And this is something we've mentioned in previous podcasts about almost bringing in a morality into football, which is very Cruyffian and very Guardiola at the moment. And Guardiola playing the beautiful football, Mourinho trying to spoil it. Guardiola and Barcelona were seen as the good guys. And of course, in football, we know that certainly behind the scenes that may or not be true. But that's, for me, what it looked like.
Yes, and as you say, this is an institutional strength of Barcelona. They market themselves very well as the club where democracy works. And more in this century, certainly with the alignment with a sort of Catalan feeling, well, the importance of locale, I think would be the mild way of putting it, but also allied very much to Catalonia's difficult relationship with Madrid, and being, you know, the underdog in that relationship. And equally, the style of football, the promotion of pass and move, and therefore, by implication, the rejection of an over-physical game. And this particular season brought that into very obvious relief.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, I think that a lot of the rest of the world were convincingly sold on this idea that there are some angels here and Jose Mourinho's on the other side.
Yes,
but I mean, his whole role is as the fallen angel. He was the one who was in heaven and is expelled from heaven, like Milton's Satan. And that's the figure he resembles with, you know, his charm, his ability in press conferences. Not that Milton Satan gave press conferences, but I'm sure if he had, they would have been excellent press conferences.
I've no doubt.
And Mourinho tries to live up to this. He plays the rebel, and you know he talked about, you know, how can we beat the establishment? How can we possibly take on this team who have referees and UEFA in their pockets? And you know, famously after the 2-0, after this first leg, he gives his whole series of sentences. You know, Porqué, why? Why did this happen? What, you know, why was there this red card in this game? Why was there this red card in that game? Why was there this red card then? And you look back and, you know, a lot of teams do have players sent off against Barcelona. And of course, the reason is that Barcelona hold the ball really well. And so players get frustrated and end up kicking them.
But the following...
And also because they're smart at playing referees.
Sure.
And of all the... Yeah, you look back at all the red cards he mentions and you look at the incident and you sort of think, well, yeah, it's fair enough. And the one that still strikes me as being weird is when they beat Arsenal and Robin van Persie was sent off for, he'd already been booked for a foul on, I think, on Dani Alves, and he gets sent off for a fraction after he's whistled for offside for putting the ball in the back of the net. I'm not even sure he had time to react to that, and it certainly wasn't dissentful, it wasn't wasting time. And Arsenal at the time was 1-1, having won the first leg 2-1, so 3-2 up on aggregate, and it 10 minutes in the second half, something like that, it kills them. And that's the one decision you can go, what was going on there? It's not a decision you commonly see. That feels a bit weird. But, you know, referees make mistakes. And there's a very good reason why, as I say, why players are often sent off against Barcelona.
Well, I'm sure while you were saying there about referees and Barcelona, if Didier Drogba is listening, he's nodding his head right now, no doubt. But Ian, as we sort of finish up on this one, you know, Mourinho, as Jonathan was saying, and yourself, was brought into... To beat this well-established Barcelona side. Following season, he did.
Yes, they won the league, which was obviously a huge triumph for Mourinho, given Barcelona's status. He also did something else, which he'd been brought in for, which was to stop getting knocked out at the last 16 stage of the Champions League, which had become a pandemic. For Madrid.
People forget that.
Jose Mourinho doesn't. So there's no question that he achieved quite a lot of what he was employed for. And I think Jonathan probably has an idea on this. Guardiola then left Barcelona, admitting exhaustion. And this particular duel had been the most exhausting.
Yeah.
aspect of his job, no question about it.
Well, those talking about those four derbies in 18 days, you know, this is a quote from Guardiola, "These aren't games I'll remember fondly," which, bearing in mind they won in the league and got them to the Champions League final, "these aren't games I'll remember fondly, regardless of the result, because they're accompanied by too many incidents that are incomprehensible to me. I think, ultimately, Mourinho won the war."
Yeah.
Those were victories from which Guardiola never recovered at Barcelona. And then, you know, he goes off, has his year sabbatical, comes back to a much more friendly environment at Bayern. And now you're on to City I'm sure the last thing Guardiola wanted to see was Mourinho coming in at United. But so far, he seems to be dominating that.
Indeed, yeah. And of course, that period, you know, what is it, sort of 7 or 8 years later, as you say, Manchester City, and a big gap considering some of the other matches and incidents we've talked about, you know, the previous podcast, it was just months apart. Why do you think now it was 8 years from this match to when we're talking about them?
Well, I think, and this is something Mourinho points out all the time, winning a league in Germany, so what, frankly, with Bayern? You know, most coaches will win the league with Bayern. They have an enormous financial advantage over everybody else. So Guardiola would point out he won the league with record points totals by playing extraordinary football, and that is totally fair. But he wasn't brought into Bayern to win the league. They could do that with anybody. He was brought in to win the Champions League, and they lost in three semi-finals. So you can't call that failure because of semi-final, and yet he didn't do what he was meant to do. So there's a sense of almost treading water there. And then he gets to City, which is sort of Barcelona redux. You know, you've got Chiqui Bagueras down there, you've got Ferran Soriano. The hierarchy is the same people as he had at Barcelona. The club has been built in his image. He obviously has great authority over things like transfers. And I think, you know, while City have spent an enormous amount of money, they've spent it incredibly well. You know, they don't have sort of a £30 million embarrassment sitting in the attic like United do. they have, you know, a really, really strong, coherent squad. And, you know, City is almost your Guardiola FC. It's a club designed for him and by him.
Which is something that perhaps Mourinho won't have. And that's the legacy, isn't it, of Barcelona going through to Guardiola. That yes, I understand, who am I to question Guardiola's thoughts, of course, but what he says about Mourinho winning the war in those four Clásicos, in that context, yes. But surely the history books, you would think, looking back at the two managers, or more Guardiola, would look at him and his style more favourably.
Probably, but two Champions Leagues each. You know, and as Mourinho said, if you win the Champions League with Porto, that kind of does mean more than winning it with Barcelona.
But in terms of influence on the game?
In terms of influence over the game, and in terms of what I think will happen in the next 10 to 15 years, I'm pretty sure Guardiola will come out on top. But you will have people take Mourinho's cause, and I understand why. And I think that's what's so fascinating about the rivalry. But because, you know, the great paradox of Mourinho is that his whole method seems to work better with underdog clubs. You know, he needs to be fighting against the system. And it's really hard to portray yourself as an underdog if you're Real Madrid or if you're Manchester United. But yeah, I mean, the contrast between Guardiola's relationship to his directors and the transfer policy to what we've seen with Mourinho this summer, only able to get in one player. You have this, you know, bizarre disputes kind of played out through various briefings to which centre-back they're even targeting. You know, that relationship at United is clearly much, much harder for Mourinho. And there seems to be a divergence of vision. I think a lot of the American directors at United don't want to be signing 28, 29-year-old proven players. They want to be signing younger players with a sell-on value. They want it to be more business-driven. Well, they got the wrong manager to do that. Mourinho's not going to be able to do that. That's not his way. Whereas Guardiola seems to have a perfectly serene relationship with his directors, much more serene than he ever had at Barcelona.
Mm. And the whole book, you know, the Barcelona legacy, starts and features heavily, of course, Johan Cruyff, Ian. Do you think Guardiola, maybe not now, perhaps, in the future it will be seen at Barcelona as the same level that Johan Cruyff is?
Yes, I do, because I think his era will be remembered with particular fondness, the era of, yeah, Guardiola's coaching. I think what it might require is for Guardiola to, sometime in the future, more explicitly commit himself to the club as a place of belonging. Mm. Now, clearly, he can't do that now because he belongs to Manchester City, and he's, you know, needs to be very corporate about that. But I think that's what it would take, because the club wants to be loved by a great like him, as Cruyff always did. Cruyff spent the rest of his life there. He was always engaged with the club, sometimes to the annoyance of their actual employees. So I think that would have to happen in the future for him to be on the same pedestal.
Mm-hmm. But it is possible, Jonathan.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult, and because whoever comes first is always going to be more important. And you can make a comparison with Liverpool, say, where Bill Shankly's still the one who's revered, but Bob Paisley's more successful. Bob Paisley won much more. Mm. You know, Bill Shankly never won a European Cup. But Shankly's the one who created Liverpool as we know it. And you know, Barcelona, Cruyff will always be the one who created Barcelona as we know them. For all Guardiola's successes, he's the one who came after. So, yeah, I mean, maybe if he goes back and I don't know, in 10 years becomes manager again or takes on some kind of sporting director role, or even just becomes this sort of Emnon Squeeze writing his columns in Spanish newspapers, that being sort of the moral conscience of a club, maybe he can achieve parity. But to displace the man who came first, you know, whose ideas he took on. Yeah, that's the whole point of the book, is he took on those ideas. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the progenitor is always going to be more important than the disciple.
Absolutely. Well, there we are, ladies and gentlemen. That was the last of our six-part podcast series to coincide with the release of The Barcelona Legacy, a book that explores how the evolution of today's game begins at Barcelona 25 years ago when the pioneering ideas of Johan Cruyff was taken on by the likes of Louis van Gaal, Jose Mourinho and Pep Guardiola. Ian Hawke, thank you very much. Pleasure. And Jonathan, pleasure, of course. And thank you very much, good listeners, for listening to this. Go and buy the book.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Did you know that Xavi Hernandez used to scan over 8 times in the 10 seconds before receiving the ball? It's therefore not surprising that he rarely lost it. Scientific studies have shown just how important scanning is in soccer. Players who scan more, for example, make twice as many successful forward passes than those who scan less. But training this skill is difficult, and that's why thousands of players trust Be Your Best, the soccer training app in virtual reality, designed to improve players' game intelligence. To learn more, visit beyourbest.com and use code POD20 to get 20% off your first subscription.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.